You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to Russia lost his father to an assassin when he was just 6 years old. Now, in a very personal collection of letters, he urges his young sons and other Muslims to embrace moderate Islam and reject hatred and violence. We'll hear his story.
First, the internet media company BuzzFeed has been the target of criticism after it released an unconfirmed 35-page dossier of embarrassing information about President-elect Donald Trump, allegedly gathered by Russian intelligence officials.
Beyond the criticism from President-elect Trump and his staff, the decision sparked a debate about the role of media outlets and whether the public is best served through total transparency, even when information is unverified.
Jeff Seglin joins us now to talk about the ethical ramifications of the release of that document. He's a faculty member at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he writes the Right Thing column, which looks at general ethics. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's first listen to incoming White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer's remarks from the news conference yesterday where he condemned the report.
It's frankly outrageous and highly irresponsible for a left-wing blog that was openly hostile to the president-elect's campaign to drop highly salacious and flat-out false information on the internet just days before he takes the oath of office. According to BuzzFeed's own editor, there are some serious reasons to doubt the allegations in the report. The executive editor of the New York Times also dismissed the report by saying it was, quote, totally unsubstantiated, echoing the concerns that many other reporters expressed on the internet.
Now, there is incoming Press Secretary Sean Spicer. And on the other hand, BuzzFeed said they were practicing transparency. They were letting the public decide and that these documents were circulating at the highest levels of government. So, Jeff, who's right?
Among journalists for months as well.
And Jeff, what do you think about those two sides of the argument?
The documents were out there, and the key word for journalists doing business is they were unsubstantiated. So the reason that they didn't see press from other outlets was that they weren't substantiated. They didn't know who the source of the documents were, and they didn't know if the documents were true. So making an argument for transparency is not particularly a legitimate one in this particular case, because it would argue for just publishing anything, whether you knew it was accurate or not, which is not how you practice good journalism.
Well, for those of us who didn't go to journalism school, what does it mean to verify a story? And in this case, what would have been needed to check off that particular box?
Well, I went to divinity school, so I didn't go to journalism school, but I was a journalist. I think one of the things to know first is who is the source, who's providing the information to provide the documents. Who's providing the document? Who put the document together? Those are things they didn't know when they were reviewing the documents. There's a terrific piece in the New York Times after the fact that just lays out what we did know and what we don't know. And the things we didn't know were who it was from, how legitimate any of it was, and how credible it was. And not knowing all of those things sort of rises to the occasion of not being ready for publication.
And it's certainly gotten criticism from a lot of publications for those very reasons you just outlined there. On the other hand, we seem to be in a political era where there are regular, you know, we call them leaks. WikiLeaks has a lot of documents that came out during the presidential campaign, and they were at that point a matter of public record, even though they didn't come from CNN or the New York Times. I mean, are we in a new era and we just haven't realized it until now?
Well, I think we're in a new era because the access to information has changed. WikiLeaks has never pretended to be a journalistic outfit. They do data dumps, and they dump the information out there, and then people sort through it. When they first came out, I think The Guardian, in combination with the New York Times, went through it and pulled out information that they could report on credibly about what was there. So that there are media outlets that provide raw information, and then there are outlets that actually do journalism, which is trying to sort of suss out what's real and what's not.
Well, CNN has been pulled into the vortex of the criticism that we were talking about, although they did not publish the details of these documents. They just said that they existed and that President-elect Trump had been briefed on them. Do you think that was a good decision on their part?
I don't think CNN did anything that they were accused of doing at the press conference yesterday. I think they did not leak the document. They did not have any of the salacious details of the document in their report. They referenced the fact that a report existed and it was making its rounds, and they had not verified anything, so they decided not to publish it. And that seems to be a legitimate choice to make if they want to do credible journalism.
Looking at BuzzFeed's defense of releasing those documents, publishing them in their entirety, they said they err on the side of publishing. If there's a question, it seems as though many other news organizations say if there's a question, they don't publish. But BuzzFeed also said Americans, they did this so Americans can make up their own minds about the allegations. Journalistic ethics aside, which I know is the point of this conversation, but is there an argument there? Is this something that Americans should have been able to think about?
There's a great argument there, but that's also an argument that people made for fake news. I mean, we can put anything we want out there, whether it's real or not, and let the public decide whether it wants to believe it or not. That, to me, creates a mess, because then we're relying on the public to have to decide what they're seeing on their Twitter feed, what they're seeing on their Facebook pages, what they're seeing in emails that people forward to them, what they're seeing posted. Is it real or is it not real? And it's the job of the journalist and journalism outfits to provide information that's credible. So, yes, we can let the public decide for everything, but that puts an awful amount of burden on the public to decide what's real and what's not. And I don't think that's the job of a journalist to do that. The job of a journalist is not just to dump data on the reader and say, look at this. It's like the kid who, you know, goes to smell the carton of milk and says, this stinks, and then hands it to his mother and says, smell this.
Jeff Seglin is with us. He's a faculty member at the Harvard Kennedy School and a writer of the Right Thing column that takes a look at ethics. And one thing that you most journalistic organizations encounter is the need to get there first. They want to be the person who publishes. And so with CNN tiptoeing into those waters by announcing that there is such a dossier, could you make the argument that this was inevitable? Someone was going to publish this, and if you're a news organization, you might as well be the one who gets there first.
Right. So that's the idea of the get. Somebody wants to sort of get the person person to talk on the air first or get the information first, and there is a big challenge to do that. There's a big desire to do ratings, but not at the expense of getting it right. There's a great clip someplace, and I can't remember if it's Frank McGee or one of the other legendary newsmen at the time of the Kennedy assassination in 1963, where so much information, even back then, before the Internet, was coming out about what was real and what was not, and then the newsman just stopped and said, let's just get it right. And I think that was a moment that caused everybody to pause and just said, look, it's important that we get the information right. And I think that's critical now on both sides of the aisle. I mean, clearly this is not just something that's been directed towards the president-elect. It's also been dished back, where there's a lot of tweets coming from his Twitter feed that start with, credible news sources inform me. That if we want people to be able to trust what the information that's going out there, we have to provide them with information that can be trusted.
And we leave it there. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Talking to Jeff Seglin there, faculty member at the Harvard Kennedy School and writer of the Right Thing column, which looks at general ethics, talking about BuzzFeed's decision to publish a 35-page dossier with embarrassing information about Donald Trump.
Since the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, the more radical, violent offshoots of Islam have taken center stage in global politics, from Al-Qaeda to ISIS. While generating a backlash in the Western world, the popularity of violent messages has created conflicts within the Islamic world. Our next guest experienced this firsthand as he saw his children exposed to violent, hateful messages contrary to his own view of Islam.
Omar Saif Gabash has two sons. As he watched the aftermath of 9/11, he decided he wanted to share with his sons the kinds of questions they would have to face as they got older, so he wrote them a series of letters.
Omar Saif Gabash joins us now. He's ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to Russia. He's a founding trustee of the International Prize for Arabic Fiction in collaboration with the Man Booker Prize in London. His new book is called Letters to a Young Muslim. Ambassador Gabash, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
What led you to write this book, a collection of letters to your son?
Well, I think it was a realization that my older son was beginning to ask some quite fundamental questions, and it reminded me very much of what I had gone through at the same age. And it also reminded me that many of these questions still didn't have a sufficiently satisfying answer for me. So I spent a great deal of time thinking about these issues. And I suppose, in a sense, the letters are not only to my son, but they're to my 15-year-old self as well. The reason, the primary reason, is the continuing spread of radical and fundamentalist ideas that seem to be very much out of touch with the kinds of lives that we would like to be leading in the Arab world and more broadly in the Muslim community.
You encountered this in your own family. You were trying to inculcate messages in your kids. They're getting different messages from the culture, from their teachers.
Yes, and you know, this is something I think we're probably faced in all societies, that, you know, we're no longer completely, or we can no longer imagine that we're completely in control of our children's education. What they learn at school, what they learn online, the spread of ideas is something that we can't stop, but we can at least try to guide our children into evaluating ideas and to give them some kind of backbone, really. In pushing back at some ideas. So the problem, of course, is also that, you know, the teacher has a certain kind of authority, and we're encouraged to give them that authority. And yet, in some cases, I'm not going to say in all cases, but in some cases, teachers will go slightly beyond their role and spread ideas that are not particularly helpful.
And so your son came home saying that he was learning to hate other people, particular groups of people, Jews, Shia Muslims and others.
Yes, it was quite a surprising day. Surprising and not surprising, because, you know, going back about 30, 35 years, I'd been exposed to the same kind of thinking. You know, it's not that it's not kind of indoctrinated into children, but there's certainly a very strong strain out there that calls for a hatred of different groups, including the Jews. And I felt very strongly that this is completely unacceptable. You know, it was harder than I thought to try to extract this idea from my my younger son in this particular case, his mind. But you know, I'm very glad that it happened, because it allowed me to begin to think much more seriously about it, and to think of my responsibility, not just to my son but to other children out there. For them to be fed hatred of any sort, I think, is unacceptable.
In your letters, you spell out why these messages of hate, fundamental messages, radical messages, might be so appealing to a young Muslim, maybe to a young Muslim boy in particular. Looking through their eyes, what is the appeal of these messages?
Well, living life successfully and building happiness, I suppose, and achieving happiness in our daily lives is actually much more complex these days than it may have been 30 years ago, 40 years ago. There are so many conflicting demands on our attention. The appeal of a particular fundamentalist Islam is that it is very straightforward. It is you can learn it in a day. It gives you the power of God on your side. And it allows you to really to be empowered on his behalf, and it allows in certain cases, I would say that there is a theology of anger and frustration and hatred that is affected through this teaching. And I think that, you know, many people will say, "Ah, well, you know, those are the traditions." But I actually think that these are choices that are either made for us or that we make ourselves, and we need to be aware of that choice. A theology of anger and hatred and frustration is a choice. It is a way of looking at the world, and we don't have to look at the world in those terms.
You write that it's not enough to say things like Muslims are religion, or Islam, I'm sorry, is a religion of peace. The people who resort to violence are not true Muslims. You say that sounds simple and satisfying. It's not enough, though.
Well, you know, at some stage it might have been the correct response, a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to various accusations and perhaps to the rise of Islamophobia. But I think that it's time to move beyond the kind of platitude and the wishful thinking that Islam is a religion of peace. Yes, in theory it may be. But what we need to understand is that the theory of Islam is not enough. We actually need to practice it, and we need to express it. So if we see within our own community that kind of anger, frustration, and negative kind of outlook, then we really need to make a stand, not even a public stand, but really a private stand amongst ourselves, and to ask ourselves more broadly, what is the purpose of violence? Why is there a certain attitude to violence which seems to be quite relaxed in certain communities, at least in the Middle East, as you can see. And we also need to think, I think, very clearly about the consequences of violence on our own societies in the long run. an act of violence that took place in my family against my father 40 years this year, has had repercussions across four decades. And not that I'm calling for sympathy here, but I am saying that if this is what I'm feeling, then we must think about the violence that has been committed in the name of Islam against fellow Muslims right across the Middle East and the Muslim world, and to ask, is this really worth the so-called benefits that we might gain through that violence? And my answer is absolutely not.
We're talking to Ambassador Omar Saif Gobash. His new book is Letters to a Young Muslim. And you close with a call for Muslims of all ages to be individuals, to think for themselves, to evaluate the tenets of Islam themselves rather than relying on the authority they run across on the Internet or that teacher, maybe even their parents.
Well, I'm not calling for a complete revolution at the level of the individual. What I am saying is that there has to be kind of a rebalancing between the community and the individual. Because I think over the last sort of few decades, the community, the abstract community of Muslims, has now taken the lead to the detriment of the individual. And I think that the community of Muslims, our community, will be enriched when we return somewhat to the idea of the individual and the individual flourishing. It's easily misunderstood. So, for example, somebody sent me a message saying that, you know, this is a Western concept and we shouldn't be thinking in those terms. And I actually think that, no, you know, I wake up in the morning and I am a single individual. There is no group there with me, if I can say. And so, actually, this is a human idea. And it is a development, I suppose, of our economies and our societies and the technologies that we have available. So the individual is the Muslim individual is coming whether we like it or not, and it's how we begin to think about ourselves and how our theologians begin to accommodate for a rising kind of opinion and debate taking place amongst the individual Muslims of the community.
You also write about how Muslims engage with a diverse world, whether it's Muslims of different backgrounds, different approaches to the faith, non-Muslims as well, and a choice between a wall between communities or trying to engage in a positive way. Do you see hope for a movement toward that more positive engagement?
I actually think that it's inevitable. When we realize actually that there are no walls anymore anyway, and that the fact that, you know, most radical Muslims in particular, but many Muslims are online, and we are all subject to, you know, kind of the globalization of entertainment and information. Ideas spread with no clear identification as to religion or ethnic identity or ethnic source of these ideas. And so I think that there is a kind of intermingling of identity anyway. And so the idea of building a wall between ourselves and the outside world may have worked, you know, in the age of the camel and the horse and maybe even the cart. But it doesn't work in the modern world where we travel all the time and we live in multicultural societies, even where we think we don't. So I think it's inevitable that we will come to a realization that there is no inside and outside, there is no friend and foe, that we are all mixing and sort of exchanging identities all the time.
In the West, there's sometimes the view that Islam is one thing and it's hostile to Western traditions. There's a clash of civilizations. A group like ISIS might agree 100% like that from the other side of things. In a way, they're working together to keep these battles going. How do people on either sides of that debate try not to let those messages win out?
Well, the messages are coming out, and they're coming out in quantity. What I think is that, you know, increasingly my fellow Muslims are discovering that there is a silent majority that is trying to express its opposition to this aggression and this violence and this antipathy to the West. You know, we are intrinsically related and connected to the West, whether it's economically, whether it's counting our money in dollars, or whether it's the technologies that we use to interact with each other and the entertainment that we enjoy. So I think that what I'm trying to do in this book is to put forward a basic kind of structure for a modern conversation about these issues. amongst, I'd say, the silent majority. And hopefully they won't be so silent anymore, that we will be able to, in fact, perhaps absorb some of the frustrations of the radicals who think that they're on the right path, but are sorely misguided. I think, I don't want to be sympathetic to the radicals, but there is certainly a number of people who would be attracted by a radical message if they didn't find that there was a constructive way with which we could engage with the girl, with the world. And what I think is that's precisely what we're trying to do, which is give people within our community the tools to understand how we can mix how we can express the values of the Quran and the Prophet, which are basically the values of fairness and justice, how we can express that in the 21st century in a constructive manner.
You write that the radical violent message is loud, it's well-funded, it's simple for people to grasp and latch onto. Can you compete with that?
Yeah, I think we can. I think that, people will get tired of the death and destruction within a particular strain of Islam, and we will see a turning back from that. So I'm optimistic. I'm very optimistic, primarily because I have faith in the resources, both sort of intellectual and moral resources of Islam.
Ambassador Gobash, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Omar Saif Gobash, ambassador of the United Arab Emirates to Russia, author of the new book Letters to a Young Muslim. In his State of the State address on Tuesday, Governor Walker said Wisconsin's economy is strong and that more people were employed last year than at any point in the state's history.
This contrasts with the view of some Democrats who say Wisconsin is lagging behind in job growth. Other critics say Wisconsin's economy is buoyed up by the national economic recovery.
Here's what the governor had to say about the state of Wisconsin's jobs.
In fact, our biggest challenge is not creating jobs, but finding people to fill them. We went from a focus on jobs, to talking about workforce. That will be my top priority for 2017 and beyond.
Stephen Deller is here with us now. He is professor and community development specialist in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Governor Walker, in his State of the State address this week, he made the case that the economy in Wisconsin is looking good, he says. Unemployment is down, the tax burden is down, there's more money in people's pockets. Overall, do you agree with that?
In a nutshell, yes. The economy finally has started to pick up. I think the frustration has been that Wisconsin has continued to lag behind the national economy. Even when you look at some of the indicators that Wisconsin's actually doing good in, we're lagging behind the national economy. Now, having said that, Wisconsin needs to make a decision. Are we satisfied with the slow rate of growth?
And what does that mean? What does the answer mean?
Well, it depends. I think one of the problems is that we've finally gotten to a point where we have more jobs in the state of Wisconsin than we had before the Great Recession started. If we had grown at the national rate or the same rate as some of our peers, we'd have a lot more jobs in the state. I think one of the questions that is lost is the nature of the jobs that we're generating. A lot of the jobs, we're almost getting a bifurcation of the labor market here and the types of jobs that are being generated. We have jobs growth at the low end of the scale, of the employment scale, in terms of education requirements, skills, experience, and the type of pay and the benefits. And we're also getting job growth at the higher end. The problem is that most of the job growth is at that lower end.
We had Minority Leader Jennifer Schilling giving the remarks after the speech. She said wages have declined. Poverty is at a 30-year high. She didn't see the rosy picture that the governor was painting. Do you agree with some of what she had to say?
That's true. If we look at the most recent data over the past 6 months or so, we're finally starting to see wages starting to increase a little bit, which is a positive sign. But again, we've got that kind of group of jobs being generated at the low end of the spectrum and a small group of jobs being generated at the higher end of the spectrum. So that average is getting pulled up a little bit, but it's because of the performance of the well-to-do.
And looking at the matching the workforce to the jobs, matching people to the jobs that are available, the governor said he could find anyone a job. What does that mean for the economy when we shift the focus from creating jobs to looking at the workforce and their fitness for the jobs?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is, again, go back to the type of the jobs that we're generating in this state. Yeah, I can get a job if you're willing to work minimum wage with no benefits. There are a lot of jobs like that that are being generated, and they're a little bit above the minimum wage. I mean, like in Wisconsin, in Madison, for example, the minimum wage is irrelevant because the labor's so tight here. But if you want an entry-level position that pays fairly low with minimal, if any, benefits, yeah, there's a lot of jobs out there. And that's where a lot of the labor shortage is occurring, is that these jobs are simply not sustainable jobs.
We're talking with Steve Deller right now, economist from UW-Madison, looking at the economic state of things as painted by Governor Walker in his State of the State address and what it means going forward. Another line from Governor Walker's State of the State address, Steve. He said property taxes as a percentage of personal income are the lowest they've been since World War II. What do you make of that assessment?
Well, that's true, but it's come at a price. Look at the transportation system that we have. One of the biggest ticket items that a lot of local governments have is the road system. And the road system is really starting to fall behind. So, yeah, we have lower taxes, but it's coming at the price of our infrastructure starting to fall apart. We also have the problem that a lot of our property tax dollars goes to K-12 education. And a lot of schools are really, really suffering. And here's, again, we're getting this divide. Schools can go to referendum to bypass the property tax levy limit. And those tend to be passing in communities that are a little bit wealthier. Poorer communities, more rural communities, they just are really kind of caught between a rock and a hard place.
I want to pick up on where you started there with the infrastructure in Wisconsin. What do you think happens to the economy when that is the case? Is there a direct correlation between infrastructure that's not kept up to date, not maintained, and the health of the economy?
Oh, there's a direct link. When I moved to Wisconsin over 20 years ago, Wisconsin had a reputation of having some of the best roads in the U.S. But again, because of budget cuts, because of delayed maintenance, because of the property tax levy limits, our infrastructure, our road system in particular, is really taking a hit. The problem that we face is that as the roads are deteriorating, the cost of maintaining them goes up exponentially. You can think of it as the roof on your house. If there's a couple of bad shingles, it's fairly inexpensive to replace it. But when you have limited funds or no funds or declining funds, you naturally go, well, I'm going to delay. I'm going to wait. Well, what happens to your roof? At a certain point, you end up having to replace the entire roof. If you wait even longer than that, you get water damage into the house. You got to repair that now. So this kind of idea of lowering taxes, isn't that great. It comes at a price, and that price is going to be failing infrastructure, the drain on the economy, and more cost, higher taxes down the road to fix it.
What about the idea that if people have more money in their pockets because their tax burden is lower, they put that money back into the economy and rising tide lifts all boats?
It depends on who you're giving the tax cuts to. If you're giving the tax cuts to the high end, the kind of the supply side argument, let's give the wealthy a tax cut because then they'll invest in the economy. That's not necessarily true. We've been trying to do that since the Reagan administration, and it simply does not work. If you give tax cuts to lower income, say increasing the earned income tax credit, or lowering the tax margins on the lowest income, that has a stronger effect on the local economy because lower income people will spend that money, whereas higher income people, they tend to sit on it.
And before we get our callers in on this, something else Governor Walker said during his State of the State, I don't know the exact wording, but basically he said we're better off. Everybody's better off than they were 4 or 8 years ago. True?
If you look back to where we were before the Great Recession hit, yes, we are finally better off. But if you compare us to our neighbors other than Michigan. Thank God for Michigan because it makes us look good. But if you compare us to our neighbors and you compare us to the national economy, we're not doing that good.
Stephen Deller is with us right now. He's an economist from UW-Madison, and we're taking a look at Governor Walker's State of the State address given this weekend, looking at the economic outlook that he painted and getting another take on that right now.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What does Wisconsin's economy look like from where you stand? Have Governor Walker's economic policies, as you see it, helped or hurt you, your community, your local government? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about Wisconsin's economy and trying to get a snapshot of its future given Governor Walker's plans in his State of the State address.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you rate Wisconsin's economy and economic progress under Governor Walker? Do you see a lot of job opportunities out there, maybe jobs for you? And do you see, if you're an employer, do you see a shortage of workers, as the governor was suggesting was out there? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Stephen Deller stays with us. He's an economist with UW-Madison. And let's go first to Pete in Green Bay. Pete, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to call in. I didn't hear the governor's speech last night, but I heard your comments earlier saying that he's saying that everybody's better off than they were before he took office. That's not the truth for me as a state employee. I haven't had a real pay raise since he took office. And before that, we were taking furlough days. So I'm way worse off. Paying a whole bunch of my pay now is going towards things like retirement and health care, and I have no discretion over that. I made more money, I'm sure, in real terms 10 years ago than I do today.
Pete, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate that. And Steve, what do you say to Pete, state employee?
Well, as a fellow state employee, I'm sympathetic to your position. I do a lot of workshops around Wisconsin and talking about the local economy. And one of the things that I'm always kind of surprised at is that when you get into a lot of communities, the public sector oftentimes is one of the biggest employers. When you get into smaller rural communities, it's oftentimes the public school system. And when you look at the lack of pay raises, you look at actual cuts in real income, as Pete pointed out, there's a massive change to the benefits program, which resulted in a large reduction in take-home pay. Those have actually hit these small rural communities in a very negative way. And it's a real eye-opener for a lot of rural residents, community residents across the state, to realize that a lot of the jobs in the public sector are actually not bad-paying jobs. And the current policies are essentially taking a very negative impact on those jobs.
Pete, thanks a lot for calling. And we'll take another call now from Derek in Merrill. Hi, Derek. Derek, you there? And he just dropped. We missed that. And let's take Jerry next in Armstrong Creek. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I just want to piggyback on what that public worker said. Actually, Governor Walker increased taxes by over $1 billion when he took and cut the middle class, which all the public workers and the teachers. And the unintended consequences of doing that dropped our average wage in the state by over $5,000. Also, the other unintended consequence of that was those people put that money into health care and retirement, so we didn't collect income tax or sales tax because they couldn't spend that money in the economy. And that really is holding us back as an economy. That's the unintended consequences of what happened when he did that.
Jerry, thank you for that. And Stephen, getting at what you were talking about earlier, some people not putting the money back into the economy, but using it in other places that they need it more, maybe.
I think that's correct.
All right, Jerry, thank you for that. Pat joins us next in Hartford. Pat, hello.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, thank you.
I work for a manufacturer in Hartford. We're a foundry, and we are having trouble filling manufacturing jobs, permanent, sustainable, relatively high, or at least well-paying jobs, and have actually for quite some time. So while I don't agree necessarily that what Walker says is guaranteed to be true, at least in this little niche of Wisconsin, or area of Wisconsin, there are jobs available that are, have been hard to fill.
Pat, thanks a lot for that. And what do you think about that?
You do get in some parts of Wisconsin where you have some larger employers that are having a difficult time, and they are finding that they're needing to increase their wages and whatnot, which is positive. But this gets back to the transportation question that we were talking about before, is that you have to look at a much larger labor market area in which to draw those workers, which means that you have to have good transportation system in order for workers to get to those jobs. We see it a lot in the Milwaukee area, where there's a surplus of labor in the city and a shortage of workers out in the suburbs, but you cannot get from the city out to the jobs in an efficient manner, in an effective manner. You get the same thing in a lot of rural Wisconsin, where you just have to draw from such a large labor pool or a large labor market that it just doesn't make sense for people to commute to fill these jobs. And then you add on top of that deteriorating road system, and it makes it even more difficult.
Do other cities have solutions that work to that commuting problem?
Appleton has been fairly aggressive in terms of trying to come up with rideshare type programs where employers will actually try to put together rideshare vans. There's been some success with that. Some employers are being a little bit more aggressive in terms of providing those things. Other things like offering on-site childcare often opens up a pool of labor that wasn't available before. So the old school manufacturer of just put an ad in the window and people will start knocking on the door, those days are gone. Employers need to get much more creative in terms of trying to attract workers and retaining those workers. And it starts with decent wages and decent benefits, and then it's above and beyond that.
One more quick call from Stephanie in Duluth. Stephanie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
I just wanted his comments on, first of all, I just want to say thank you for your input. It is fair.
And we're short on time, sides. Stephanie. Sorry.
Okay, sorry. I just was curious about his take on what Governor Walker's trying to do to the unions.
All right, Stephanie, thanks for that. And your kind words to Stephen, I'm sure, didn't go unnoticed. But Stephen, what do you have to say about how the union legislation affected the economy?
Thank you, Stephanie. Appreciate that. I think that the right to work legislation, and forget about Act 10, let's not talk about that, but the right to work, I think, is actually driving us in the wrong direction. I think when you look at states that have right to work, they generally are generating lower paying jobs and with less benefits. So again, it's this bifurcation of the labor market, and right to work is essentially feeding more jobs into that lower end of the spectrum than the better paying jobs that we really kind of want.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That was Stephen Deller, professor and community development specialist in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison.